This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, May 15, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we'll hear from Washington, where Democrats can't seem to agree on a strategy to end the war. Officials in the Philippines say they'll look into reports of possible fraud in Monday's midterm elections. And we'll hear why Paul Wolfowitz's days as the World Bank's president might be numbered. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Aaron Glantz with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Reverend Jerry Falwell, the Baptist minister who used television to bring his message to millions and then founded the Moral Majority to help politically mobilize the religious right, has died. He was 73.
He was a small Baptist pastor in a small town in Lynchburg, Virginia, who was courted by the political right to try to help mobilize the conservative religious community.
The Reverend Catherine Ragsdale is executive director of Political Research Associates, which monitors the religious right. She calls Falwell's passing iconic and says he will be remembered most for founding the Moral Majority, which registered millions to vote and advocated for social and moral issues, including overturning the Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion.
The Moral Majority played on the silent majority catchphrase that had preceded it and suggested that a majority of Americans held different moral standards and values than were reflected in the political sphere and had been silent in the past because they had been focusing on personal piety, and that this was a movement to energize and engage them to bring their values into the public sphere. Now, we would contend that it's not true that a majority of Americans or even of religious Americans held such conservative and we would say in many cases repressive values, but it was a tagline and it was a strategy that worked.
The Reverend Catherine Ragsdale is executive director of Political Research Associates. We'll have more on Falwell's passing later on in this newscast. The Pentagon has identified the son of a conservative war critic as among the U.S. service members killed in Iraq. Chuck Rosina reports from Boston.
Yesterday, Professor Basevich received the tragic news that his son, Andrew Basevich Jr., 27, was killed in Iraq. Basevich Sr. is a West Point graduate and served on the faculty there as well as Johns Hopkins University before coming to Boston University in 1998, where he teaches in the History and International Relations Department. His son was a graduate of Boston University, class of 2003. Boston University President Robert Brown released a short statement through his spokesperson, Colin Riley.
The death of Andy Basevich is a tragic loss of a fine young man. The thoughts and prayers of the entire Boston University community go to Professor Basevich and his family.
As an outspoken critic of the Bush Doctrine, Basevich wrote in a recent Boston Globe op-ed, quote, "Our reckless flirtation with preventive war qualifies as not only wrong, but also stupid. Indeed, the Bush Doctrine poses a greater danger to the U.S. than do the perils it supposedly guards against," unquote. He also wrote an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times at the start of the invasion, quote, "If, as seems probable, the effort encounters greater resistance than its architects imagine, our way of life may find itself tested in ways that will make the Vietnam War look like a mere blip in American history," unquote. Although opposed to the Iraq War, Basevich believed in military service and was proud of his son. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina in Boston.
Halliburton's CEO leaves for Dubai following the company's annual shareholder meeting in Houston tomorrow. As he goes, the company remains under scrutiny for shoddy work that may be linked to missing oil in Iraq. From Houston, Renee Feltz reports.
Halliburton's performance on an old oil services contract called Restore Iraqi Oil may be linked to billions of dollars of missing Iraqi oil discovered by the U.S. Government Accountability Office. Just how much oil is missing is hard to determine because Halliburton and another company, Parsons, failed to install and calibrate meters on oil platforms rebuilt in the Arabian Gulf. CorpWatch's Prothop Chatterjee.
We realize there's a potential, but there's no proof it's being stolen. And the reason there's no proof it's being stolen is because the meters have been fixed.
Opponents of war profiteering plan to throw a going-away party for Halliburton in front of Wednesday's shareholder meeting with the theme, Take the Money and Run. From Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
12 Palestinians were killed today and dozens others wounded after fierce gun battles broke out between Hamas gunmen and security forces linked to President Mahmoud Abbas of Fatah. Rami Amagari reports.
Palestinian security sources report that scores of Hamas's gunmen attacked a national security outpost in eastern Gaza this morning, opening heavy fire that killed 7 security personnel and wounded 17 others. Hamas claims it has no relation with the casualties, saying the Israeli army stationed in the area fired tank shells on the post. Israeli army spokesperson stated that the army killed two Palestinian security personnel when the latter fled to their border fence with Gaza. Since Friday, at least 20 people have been killed and more than 50 others wounded after renewed factional infighting returned to Gaza streets. Palestinian Interior Minister Hani Al-Kawasmi resigned yesterday, unable to secure cooperation by rival parties. For Free Speech Radio News and IMEMC.org, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
And I'm Aaron Glantz for Free Speech Radio News.
Paul Wolfowitz's days may be numbered at the World Bank, despite the White House's continued support of Wolfowitz. A bank committee yesterday said Wolfowitz has violated ethics rules. White House spokesperson Tony Snow, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice are all backing Wolfowitz's post as bank president and are opposed to his removal. Today, he met with the full bank board to see if he'll get to keep his job. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
We won't miss Wolfowitz!
We won't miss Wolfowitz!
Unless he quits! Fire Wolfowitz! Unless he quits! Fire Wolfowitz! Unless he quits! Fire Wolfowitz!
As protests are growing inside and out of the World Bank against him, World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz is in day two of trying to salvage his reputation and, some say, his job. Yesterday, a bank investigating committee reported that Wolfowitz broke bank rules by arranging a pay raise for his girlfriend. Today, the bank's board met to consider a report by the committee that says his involvement represented a conflict of interest. From the beginning of his tenure at the World Bank, Paul Wolfowitz has been a controversial figure. Samir Desanti is director of the Global Network for Global Justice.
When Wolfowitz came to the bank in 2005, he came with all sort of promises of engaging in multilateralism and so on, but what he did was exactly the opposite. He hired a few of his Republican cronies from the Bush administration. He put them in really high positions, paid them immense salaries, and basically proceeded to take all decisions with this tight circle of Republicans. And that really had the effect of alienating all the bank staff who already sort of had a grudge against Wolfowitz because of the Iraq War. So he hasn't made any friends inside the institution.
Certain high-level senators agree. Senator Harry Reid, Democrat from Nevada.
Paul Wolfowitz is an embarrassment to our country. He's an embarrassment to the World Bank, and he should step down.
Several groups have been protesting outside of the World Bank in order to see that Paul Wolfowitz is made to leave. Ben Wickler is director of AVAS.com, an online global civic advocacy group. Here he is at a recent protest.
I think it's crucial to put pressure on, and it's crucial to tell the bank that if they do the right thing and have the backbone to actually fire Paul Wolfowitz, the world will applaud them.
In spite of the growing negative sentiment against Wolfowitz, the White House has been steadfast in backing him. Press Secretary for President Bush, Tony Snow.
Mr. Wolfowitz today is talking to the World Bank, presenting his side on personnel matters. And what we've said all along is, first, we do support Paul Wolfowitz. But the second thing is, he has made it clear that he made mistakes. It is pretty clear also that there were problems in terms of communicating the proper ways of dealing with personnel issues. As you know, originally he tried to recuse himself, then an ethics board said that he ought to get himself involved. The fact is that he made mistakes. They're not, in our view, firing offenses.
In addition to the calls for Wolfowitz to resign in the U.S., yesterday, 37 World Bank country directors wrote a letter to the bank's board saying that Wolfowitz's leadership is damaging the bank's reputation and fight against poverty. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
Christian fundamentalist televangelist Jerry Falwell died today after being found unconscious Tuesday in his office. Falwell, who co-founded Moral Majority, may be best known for his often contentious political remarks and views, including his support of apartheid in South Africa and statements like, "God is a Republican." In this recording, preserved by the Pacifica Radio Archives, Falwell held a press conference in Washington, D.C. on what was then a new epidemic of AIDS in 1983.
I believe that when one breaks the laws of nature and the laws of moral decency, whether it's an addiction to drugs, whether it's an addiction to alcoholic beverages or promiscuous heterosexual activity resulting in the various venereal diseases, or, and I do believe homosexuality is a moral perversion, participates in every kind of bloody and filthy kind of sexual activity, that we break natural and moral laws of decency. And when one does that, when we go against nature, and God, of course, is the creator of nature, we therefore pay the prices for that. Every former drug addict can tell you that. Every former alcoholic can tell you that. We have led many homosexuals to Christ, who are now living very normal and productive lives, and as Christians, they tell us that the scars of those years in the homosexual community and the actions in which they involve themselves are there permanently. So I would say yes, there's no question about it. The scripture is clear. Be not deceived, Galatians chapter 6. God is not mocked or fooled or deceived. Whatsoever a man or a woman soweth, that shall that person also reap. We do reap it in our flesh when we violate the laws of God.
Jerry Falwell died today of unknown causes. He was 73. Debate on the Iraq war is back in the Senate today. Democrats offered two bills that demand the president bring U.S. troops home. As Yom Meshe reports, however, the party can't agree on the exact strategy to end the war.
Democrats attached two Iraq war proposals to unrelated water resources legislation. Both set timelines to withdraw U.S. troops from Iraq. Majority Leader Harry Reid says the bills allow senators to debate on the Iraq war policy, and senators can vote swiftly on a clean war funding bill later this week. Wisconsin Democratic Senator Russ Feingold sponsored the first bill. It would cut off funding for the war by March next year. Michigan Democrat Carl Levin says he won't support Feingold's proposal.
Now, we favor leaving troops with a limited mission, but I can't support a cutoff of funds as I read that amendment, and I can't support a fixed date for the removal of all of the troops.
Instead, Levin offers his own bill. His proposal requires president start pulling out U.S. troops this October. It also sets a goal to withdraw all combat units by March next year.
So we would provide both the funding for the troops, at the same time express the congressional will that the Iraqi leaders should get on with a political settlement.
The Levin bill allows the president to waive the deadlines. Levin says he sweetened the proposal in order to avoid a veto from Bush. However, Bush doesn't take the bait. White House spokesperson Tony Snow.
The president's made it very clear here that he is not doing deadlines for withdrawal. He is not going to do something that's going to tie the troops' hands.
Nebraska Democrat Ben Nelson voted against timelines for troop pullout before. He says a better approach is to set benchmarks for the Iraqi government.
If they meet all the benchmarks, why would you have a date for withdrawal? I mean, that's the question I have. How can you anticipate that they're not going to make some of those benchmarks?
Democrats need 60 votes to move the two bills forward. Deputy Majority Leader Richard Durbin wants Republicans to join Democrats' side.
Two Republican senators, the senator from Oregon, Senator Smith, the senator from Nebraska, Senator Hagel, have stepped forward and joined us on the Democratic side. We need nine more. With nine more Republican senators, the failed policy in Iraq will change.
Republicans are likely to offer two bills to match Democrats' proposal. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says Republicans are working on the drafts, but he gives very few details on those proposals.
Most Republican senators, as I've indicated to you previously, are open to benchmarks, and I've also indicated I think there's widespread frustration with the Iraqi government, and clearly these benchmarks are going to be directed toward the Iraqi government and its performance, or at least so far its lack of performance.
Republicans will disclose their bills later today, and the Senate is likely to finish voting on all Iraq war proposals tomorrow. In the meantime, the Pentagon reports that it has to move money from other purposes to fund troops in Iraq and Afghanistan while waiting for Congress to release funding. White House spokesperson Snow says the funding delay is undermining the troops' missions.
Moving money around like this, as we've said before, creates uncertainty and inefficiency, and it ultimately costs taxpayers more money in the long run by wreaking havoc on existing funds and forcing, in some cases, people to make inefficient decisions in the long run about how to finance ongoing operations.
The Senate will vote on the $124 billion war funding bill this week. Both parties say they plan to send money to the troops by the end of this month. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
Philippine election officials today vowed to look into reports of fraud in Monday's midterm elections as the slow process of counting votes continues. The vote has also been marred by violence that has left more than 120 people dead since January. FSRN's Gurley Linao reports from Manila.
Tensions remained high in the Philippines as millions of votes in Monday's congressional and local elections were counted by hand in a tedious process open to manipulation. In a province just outside Manila, gunmen torched a school building while votes were being counted, killing a schoolteacher and a poll watcher. That brought the number of election killings since January to 129. Sporadic incidents of ballot box snatching and harassment by gunmen were also reported throughout the country. Foreign and local election observers also reported that up to 100,000 people were not able to vote on Monday due to various irregularities. The Commission on Elections stressed that there was no massive cheating that was ongoing, but it vowed to investigate the reports. Benjamin Abalos is the chairman of the commission.
This election has disproven the fear and allegations before elections from the opposition that there would be massive cheating. From the initial reports, you could see that all this fear of massive cheating is belied. But we do not also deny that there were many of those who were disenfranchised, although this is not validated as to its number. Whether it is one or two, still it is a disenfranchisement. And we cannot let this go without going into the reasons why or the cause of this disenfranchisement. That is why the commission has created a committee to look into this.
Despite the assurance, opposition senatorial candidate Lauren Legarda urged the public to stay vigilant during the vote counting.
Well, it may be true that the results are really far from over. So it's important at this point that we still guard our votes very closely and guard those that are still pending in the provinces. So guarding our votes now is very essential.
A nationwide exit poll showed that opposition candidates were leading in the senatorial races. But administration bets were expected to win a majority of the more than 250 seats in the House of Representatives. Official results were not expected until after a couple of days in the local and congressional races, and up to 4 weeks in the senatorial elections. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurli Linao in Manila.
Workers from various sectors are marching in Athens and Thessaloniki, Greece today, calling for a public social security system and free and public health care. FSRN's Eris Okunomo reports from Athens.
"Give us back our money" is a central slogan for Tuesday's 24-hour strike. The strike is a joint appeal by the General Confederation of Workers of Greece, the Confederation of Public Servants, and the Workers in Struggle Front, a network of unions close to the Communist Party. At 10 a.m., thousands of workers are expected to flood the streets of Athens, Thessaloniki, and the port of Piraeus, in protest of the mishandling of social security funds by politicians and private companies. Chrysa Tsiros is a telecommunications labor representative.
For more than 50 years, social security funds have been pillaged, sometimes through laws, sometimes through dictatorial imposition. Social security funds have been used to support Greek firms, to cover national debt, and to make some people really rich. Our fund has almost vanished, since they have transformed more than 60% of it into special high-risk bonds.
The campaign started a few months ago, when a report by a national newspaper declared that various politicians from the right-wing party in government, New Democracy, and the Socialist Party in opposition, PASOK, had been using social security funds to gamble in the Greek stock exchange market. The government responded by firing the Minister of Labour, Savas Tsitsouridis, and proposing transparency reforms. However, the strike's organizers say that there must be a total reconsideration of objectives. The Workers in Struggle Front and the Communist Party go a step further by refusing to comply with EU directives to privatize social security through greater participation of private firms. Panos Kurkumoulis is a journalist and a member of the Workers in Struggle Front.
They have done this on purpose. They have bankrupted the social security funds and the healthcare system so they can more easily apply the EU-guided privatizations of the welfare state. This way, they can introduce the long-awaited social security and healthcare reforms, the privatization of the social security system, the increase of retirement age, the further lowering of benefits and pensions, deepening the collaboration of private-public in the medical sector. Today, we are sending a clear message to the government, the opposition Socialist Party, Brussels, the Union of Employers and Industrials. The funds and our social security rights are not for sale.
The Socialist Party, which was in government from 1981 to 2002, legalized the use of social security funds for investment into low-risk bonds under the supervision of a special commission. Every social security fund could be used up to 23% of savings to invest. Later, a reform allowed the board of directors of various funds to create private firms to manage these investments and limited the special commission's powers. With no transparent procedures and no clear administrative control, the 23% limit was no longer respected. Slowly, more capital was invested in bonds, but this time bonds with higher risk and higher volatility, but more returns. The local management firms were transformed into huge investment companies that some say were key players in the Greek stock market crash of 2001. This process resulted in big losses of capital for the funds. According to the president of the YSE, Yanis Panagopoulos, the losses are at least equal to 1% of the GDP.
Besides the Central Social Security Fund, IKA, that reports important losses with this reckless investment scheme, the other 24 profession-related funds have declared a loss of 1.26 billion euros.
Thousands are expected to demonstrate in the streets of Athens, Piraeus and Thessaloniki. But as far as the government is concerned, the focus on the current administration is unjustified. The Minister of Economy, Yorgos Alogoskoufis, declared that the general strike was abusive and in some cases just provocative.
It is real proof of the lack of transparency and the immorality of certain politicians. Nevertheless, it is important to remind the workers of two things. First, that the new democracy inherited the situation from the prior socialist government. And second, that we need to proceed with reforms, both the demographic pressure and our EU obligations to tighten the state budget do not allow for a margin to maneuver.
Public transport was out of service for most of the day, and more than 90 flights were cancelled since the airport workers, Olympic and Aegean, the two most important airlines, joined the general strike. Boats to the islands, trains and buses to and from Athens also shut down their services for the day. This is Aris Economou reporting from Athens.
On March 16, somebody strangled Ruby Ordeñana, a 27-year-old Nicaraguan transgender woman who lived in the Mission District of San Francisco. Ordeñana's murder is not an isolated event. There have been at least three other violent attacks on male-born, gender-nonconforming people in the Bay Area in the past year alone. The National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs annual reports have identified a similar national trend of increasing rates of transgender women of color homicides since 2005. FSRN's Puck Lowe reports.
Ruby Ordeñana's murder is a painful example of the violence trans women face, particularly if they are poor or of color. Naomi Clark works with the Sylvia Rivera Law Project in New York City.
We ask, why are the people who are being killed, you know, low-income trans women of color? It's obviously an intersection of a lot of things, not only, you know, the disproportionate violence that poor people and people of color face because of racism and classism in our society, but also, you know, women are already considered disposable people relative to men in so many ways.
Femicide, the systematic killing of women based on their gender, has different characteristics from the murders of men and often involves sexual violence. A United Nations figure asserts that between 40 and 70% of female murder victims in the United States are killed by their husbands or boyfriends. Clark continues.
You know, women's bodies and lives just being treated as tools for reproduction, for objectification, for sex. And when you add that on top of the fact that trans people are targeted due to being sort of rejects from this gender system that is supposed to be totally fixed, immutable, stable, then you have a whole picture of extreme misogyny in addition to racism and classism that's really what is killing people.
Following Ordinanya's murder, a coalition of friends, family, organizations, and community members held a memorial last week. Ana Rivera, a friend of Ordinanya, said discrimination places trans women at added risk.
Well, the issues that come up for me around Ruby's death are just some basic issues in our in the transgender community. I really think that a lot of my sisters would not have died the way they've died if they were able to get services and to access services that allowed them to further their education, get some proper housing, so they necessarily wouldn't have to be in those situations that they have been in and wound up dead.
While some organizations are lobbying to expand the scope of federal hate crime legislature to include attacks on gender nonconforming people, others say the criminal justice system can't be relied upon to protect trans women like Ruby. A study of hate crime convictions conducted by Howard University law professor Lisa Crooms suggests that current legislation against race-based hate often ends up targeting people of color. Furthermore, Communities United Against Violence, an organization in San Francisco, has documented that about 50% of all hate violence against transgender people is perpetrated by police officers. In light of this, many are skeptical that the recent extension of federal hate crimes legislation to cover gender identity, sexual orientation, and disability will lead to meaningful change. Alexander Lee works at the Transgender, Gender Variant, and Intersex Justice Project in San Francisco as an attorney. Lee argues that locking more people up for hate crimes will not create justice for the transgender community.
We need to look at all forms of violence against our community, both individual as well as those committed by institutions such as police, sheriffs, jails. And I would add to this also departments of public health that don't include treating transgender-specific healthcare as important, as well as county governments that will allow intersex, infant mutilation. Those things are levels of violence that perpetuate and encourage continuing physical hate against us by individuals, and the state needs to be held accountable for that.
In San Francisco, this is Puck Lowe, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. To find out how you can support FSRN's programming, visit our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Special thanks today to the Pacifica Radio Archives. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.